Grab your tackle and steady your rod. This week we cast our net out into the wide world of fishing with a magazine celebrating the angling lifestyle. Plus all the news that's fit for kids and a catch up with one of the best art book designers in the business. That's all ahead today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Few newspapers can rival The New York Times when it comes to sheer gravitas. It's America's newspaper of record, but its reporting reaches far beyond the borders of the USA, held up as a gold standard to be aspired to the world over. Now The Grey Lady is producing a regular kids section, following a highly positive response to an experimental one-off in May of last year. To find out more, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to the New York Times Magazine's special projects editor, Caitlin Roper.
And Caitlin, you also are the editor for the fairly new kids section at the paper as well. How do you translate, you know, the New York Times journalistic values into a children's newspaper?
Well, that's the fun of it. It's taking this very old, respected newspaper and thinking about how to make it both fun, accessible, interesting for kids. And really the main thing that I've tried to do is to think of kids the same way we would think of adults in terms of the tone and style. In other words, not speaking down to children, expecting them to only be interested in a tiny factoid of interest, you know, a little tiny fact about an octopus, let's say, but rather real stories. Of course, those stories are approximately 300 to 600 words, so they're not incredibly long, and we think very hard about the presentation, the way to engage kids in terms of the design, the way that we're telling the story, and trying to explain things that, of course, we wouldn't have to explain to adults, but without taking on sort of an overly young kind of patronizing tone that I think some content for kids, you know, has a problem with, frankly.
Tell us a bit more about the beginning of this project. I believe you started in last November, right?
So there was two issues last year. The first one came out on Mother's Day in the United States in May. It was the first one we did. And honestly, the idea to do it came before I had applied for my job at the New York Times Magazine. I thought about this question. Wouldn't it be fun? Wouldn't it be interesting to try to think about how to make the Times interesting for children? And so that was part of my memo to my boss, Jake Silverstein. One of my ideas was this kids section. So it was one of the first sections that I worked on when I began at my job. And really, you know, I didn't do market research. I talked to maybe 20 kids about the kinds of things they were interested in, but it wasn't a question of sort of, there's a demand, let's meet it. It was just what an innovative, fun, creative project to work on. And then because of the response to that first one in May, we decided not only to do a second one in November, but also to make the section monthly beginning this month in January of 2018.
And tell us for our non-US readers, how does it look like, the supplement? You know, how many pages? Is there, for example, quite a lot of, you know, pictures and interesting design, as you guys at the New York Times always do?
Yes, absolutely. So it's a broadsheet section, very much like the US or the international edition of the newspaper, you know, big giant pages and folded in half. And there's a cover, very much conceived as a cover, meant to engage and grab kids when they see this section fall out of the newspaper. And my partner in all of this project is this incredible designer, Deborah Bishop, and she's worked at many magazines, but one of the places she worked was Martha Stewart Kids, which was a short-lived magazine. But so she's thought very hard about sort of how to engage kids visually. And so we think about photography, illustration. Really, there's a lot of beautiful art on every page. And as I said before, it's sort of like we think about the stories not all as sort of giant paragraphs or longer paragraphs of text, but some of them are question and answers. Some of them are lists. Some of them take a funnier form. In an upcoming issue, we have a Mad Libs about climate change and weather. I don't know if you know what Mad Libs is, but you know, it's sort of a fill in the blank, kind of a funny game for kids. We think about different ways to engage them with games. So there is a lot of fun in the treatments of these stories, even though the stories themselves are sometimes on serious topics like deferred action, kids who came to this country whose parents do not have legal status here. We did a profile of a young dreamer in our November issue. And in fact, one of the readers, one of the adult readers who read the section, read the story and was so moved by it that they offered to pay for the rest of the college education of that student.
That's amazing. And I love, from what I can see, the non-patronizing tone you guys are having with kids. And another thing that I thought actually was quite patronizing, people say, oh, kids, you know, probably just check their mobile devices in the future. Well, perhaps not. And I think you guys are proving it. I think you even mentioned to me, like, anecdotally, that actually kids do like a print, you know, print newspaper or books. And I think this will not change, right?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I completely agree. In fact, one of the really fun things about this job is when a section comes out, a lot of kids and their parents send in pictures either via social media or sending to my email. And we'll see pictures of, let's say, two siblings or three friends gathered around the section, trying to fill out a quiz or, you know, sitting with their parents as their parents are drinking coffee, reading the paper, or even just lying back, a little kid leg sticking out from underneath like a giant newspaper. I think there's some real fun in engaging with the physical paper and in the giant space that we are allowed to play in terms of design and storytelling.
And if I may ask, Caitlin, did you look for any other kids' magazines for inspiration, for example? I don't know how big is the market in the US for those type of publications.
I did look around a little and I found some interesting, innovative stuff being done, especially digitally. But a lot of the print magazines I found, without being disrespectful, to be, like I said sort of at the beginning, a little bit too much of this sort of a starburst shape on the page and then a little fact inside of it. Not longer stories for kids to engage with. And so I didn't really like a lot of that stuff. That's part of why I was motivated to try to do this project.
Or sometimes, I mean, from my own experience here in the UK, I just look and they're kind of just promoting, I don't know, the latest Disney release. It's kind of those magazines, but, you know, slash promotion of films as well. I don't know, probably you have that in the US.
I think we do. And I think there is some of that too. And I think there's this expectation, like the kinds of subjects that kids like, let's give them that. And what I'm hoping we can do in the Times is to give them a mix of stories that are about the kinds of things they care about in their lives. For instance, in an upcoming issue, we have a story about substitute teachers and the relationship between substitutes and kids. And that story is written by a 13-year-old. So that's an example, you know, of a story that might come to meet kids where they are. But then we also have a story about the kids in the U.S. There's 21 youth plaintiffs who are suing the federal government here in the U.S. about climate change. And that's an example, you know, of course, of kids being involved, but also, you know, a serious subject. You know, I have a story in an upcoming issue about the Black Panther movie, which is coming out in February. So there's really a range, but the idea is not to expect that kids both have a very, very short attention span and only care about things that are, you know, toys or games.
Caitlin, I think after hearing you say, I think I should start reading the kids section as well, even though I'm far away from being a kid at the moment. But tell us, when is the next issue coming?
So the next issue is in the newspaper on Sunday, January 28th. And then for the rest of the year for 2018, it will appear in the fourth Sunday of every month in the newspaper, in the Sunday New York Times. And though it is print only at this time, we are considering the possibility of a digital version. So I can't promise that will happen, but it is something we are considering.
That was Caitlin Roper, Special Projects Editor of the New York Times Magazine, in conversation with our own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. As executive editor for design and pop culture at German art book publisher Taschen, Julius Wiedemann knows more than most about the printed page. Luckily for us, he's also a friend of the show and joins us now to tell us what he's been up to, browse a few of his favourite titles on newsstands at the minute. Julius, welcome back to The Stack. Good to have you with us. Normally I would do all the pleasantries, but I want to jump straight into some of the magazines you brought with you because it's going to tee up an interesting sort of topic for us. Maybe just tell us, certainly these first two that you've got, what you've brought and maybe why in this particular week you've chosen these titles.
You know, I think, you know, we've been like slightly over a week into the year, and then I was very happy actually to find two things. One, I knew it was like Edel Rodriguez, this illustrator based in New York, was born in Cuba, moved to the US when he was 7. And then he created this great iconography about Donald Trump, which has these, you know, the face is orange, has yellow, very simple drawings. It does kind of a style that looks like a print that was done like with maybe wood or maybe this thing. The people has gone mad online with his work because he's been doing that now almost like every week. At some point, you know, he did this Donald Trump hanging, like holding the head of the Statue of Liberty. And then the Spiegel magazine in Germany looked at his works like, I know, we want this for the cover. So, I know, it's been online now for over a week. I said, I know, we don't care. It's like, it's so good. And so I saw his work again and he posted on his Instagram. And then the other magazine, which has to do with Trump patriotism and nationalism and stuff, which is the... an illustration for the New Yorker magazine, the cover by Mark Ulrichsen. I love both these guys, and my special relation to them is that I published them in my first book on illustration I did for Tashin about 10 years ago now. And it's so interesting to see that the field of illustration has just grown bigger, more mature, and more important.
Well, and on that point, we're talking about politically very sensitive, and you mentioned with that Time cover how, you know, you're guaranteed to get opprobrium from the sort of bottom half of the internet. People who get they arrive angry and get angrier. But it's an opportunity, isn't it, for illustrators? They don't have some of the same constraints that, for example, photographers have. I mean, it's to state the obvious, but it's an opportunity when you have somebody like Trump, when everything is about invective and who shouts loudest. The landscape opens up, doesn't it, for great illustrators. Their voice can be uniquely perfect at sort of fitting the moment.
What I think is fascinating with illustrators these days is that, you know, it's going to be the combination of the narrative that they want to take on, but the style that they create. In the case of Adele, is very unique. So, you know, you see, he says, you don't need to say anything. It's like, it's his work. But it's also this freedom about shape, about message, about, you know, being able to adapt to any medium as well. Because you will be doing a magazine cover, as he did, for example. And then he did a little illustration that he animated for the cover as well. And I think that adaptability on all levels, from the language to the narrative, to the visual language, to the colors, to the medium, I think that's incredible. Just to think that 20 years ago, with all the revolution that happened within computer graphics, people thought illustration was dead. And it's been more alive than ever before.
I always find this interesting if I talk to people with a great passion for illustration. I guess if we look at all of graphics or graphic art, I mean, it used to be called commercial art when it began. And yet now it's definitely an art form of its own, and this is a particular aesthetic. Why has that happened? Because I agree, people said, you know, digital spells the end for the art of the illustrator, but the absolute opposite is the case. Why is that?
It was Mark Gizmo. He was the vice president for the art critics in the UK, and then we were both doing a lecture in Berlin, and then people asked him, you know, what is the difference between art and illustration? And his explanation was brilliant. It was like, whilst illustration conveys a message, art is the message. What we have been seeing over the last decades, there's also a kind of fusion, you know, between one thing and the other. You mentioned, for example, commercial art. Now, we don't know sometimes the distinction between the design and the illustration as well. You know, Christoph Niemann, that German illustrator that was based in New York for a long time and is part of the series on Netflix, he is one of these guys as well that you can't, you know, is this really just illustration? Is this, these people, they studied design, they didn't study art, so they come from that background. I think it's actually good when there's no clear distinction between these fields anymore, because then you get people that will transition between one and the other. They'll find people that will give them more freedom to work, which I think is a lot the case of Mike Ulrichsen and Edel Rodriguez especially.
absolutely. Tell us a little bit then about how that blurring and that extra freedom, does that shape your own editorial agenda? If we're looking at, say, the books that you're looking at, you know, for Tashin looking into the future, does the topics and themes that you're looking at as in 2018 and beyond, does it reflect that fluidity, I suppose?
It totally does. It totally does. To have an idea, we now editing the second volume of a book on graphic design. We're trying to tell the story of graphic design of the 20th century. We started in 1890, just like a little bit before that. One of the biggest questions we had was like, should we include web design within graphic design? It is a conceptual question that is not easy to answer because it is graphic design, but it's also interface design. And then eventually you have interactive designers. What is the importance of that within graphic design? At the end, what is the interesting thing is that we decided not to include a lot of digital. We left web design out of the equation for this book. So we're focusing much more on print material. But what we're doing is that we're doing a book on the history of web design starting from 97, which is when Google was registered as a company. So we thought, you know, this is a kind of a completely different field. It can't be that like in 50 years, we have to go back and say, actually, this is part of it. But for the time being, we thought, you know, we have enough material to consider graphic design something that is more related to print. But we are including, for example, works from Adele Rodriguez and Christoph Niemann.
That's really interesting. So I guess if we are in a time machine and we travel forward 100 years and look back, will we break these things up by, you know, the digital age or the web design age? What will be, I mean, it's an impossible question to answer now, but it's fun to speculate. What will be the break? Do you think it will be around that sort of mid to late 1990s when there did seem to be a decisive shift? Or do you think with hindsight, we may look and say, oh, actually, you know, it was the dawn of computing or the dawn of home computing in the 80s or something like that. Can you guess where the sort of ages, the eras will, where the breaks will be?
Yeah, it's interesting. For example, let's take one example, like the CD, which was launched in 82. And then it was basically the declaration of death for vinyl. And vinyl is now back, you know, full
growing.
On.
I mean, number of sales are growing. Again, yeah.
It's selling more in some cases than download, depending on the way you compare. It's not yet bigger than streaming, I think, but it's, you have exhibitions now just about covers, or you have exhibitions or the prints or the stuff that people used to do, the covers, the photographers that did the covers, they're now completely, again, on the spot, on the spotlight. So what I think we will have to look at, because of technological changes, instead of looking at longer phases, we'll look at more waves of things coming back and forth. I think illustration is again an example of that, that people almost thought it was dead 20 years ago. Like if you have told your parents that you would be an illustrator 20 years ago, so, oh my God, no, please, you know, we don't need another person starving in the family. But now you have people that they do that, and then they're doing an exhibition for Cartier, and then, you know, the next month they're doing a book that they're creating their own stuff, then they're animating stuff. The digital is more a tool than anything else. It will interfere a lot, but it will not kill necessarily most of the things.
I could talk to you all day about this, Julius. Tell us a bit more then about what you're working on at the present. Can you reveal everything? I don't know, what are some things secret? Are some things in the public domain? Can you whet our appetites a little?
No, I wanted to make a comment about the stuff we're working regarding illustration, and we. So I'll start with like Jamie Hewlett, he came here as well, but it's exactly one of these good examples of someone that is transitioning between illustration and art. You know, his work is really deserves much more than just be considered, oh, you know, he's like a pop illustrator or something like that. But we're still very interested in finding new spaces where illustration thrives. And one title we just recently decided to do is about the history of science illustration. Scientists, they have been using illustration for hundreds of years to explain their discoveries. Now it's time for them to be on the spotlight as well.
Mm. I was going to say something like the double helix, which the, now we all, double helix, we all glibly say, oh yes, of course, I know what that is. But yeah, that's because we've seen a representation of it.
Absolutely, yeah. For example, there's a 3D model of the double helix at the Science Museum here in London, which is amazing. I recommend everyone to go there and see it. But it's also like before that, there was someone who's like, no, this is what I mean. And then they sketched something to show to the supervisor, to show to the professor, to a commission, you know, what they were talking about through drawings. And we published a lot of stuff with information graphics, which is slightly different.
But at its heart is the same thing. It's a sort of a simplification process, an educational process, isn't it? We've talked to you, I think, about some of those books, which are amazing before. It's always wonderful to speak to you, Jess. It's been great to have you with us. And we'll just have to get you in to come in again sooner and talk to us again.
Thank you very much. How about that? Yeah, no, it's fantastic. Thank you.
Finally, on today's programme, Fallon's Angler is a fishing magazine that eschews, in its own words, the incessant barrage of tackle and tactics that characterises most titles on the topic. Instead, it focuses on long-form articles illustrating the richness of the angling lifestyle. Here's Fernando speaking to its editor, Garrett Fallon.
Pleasure to welcome here at Monaco 24. Let's talk about Fallon's Angler. What an amazing magazine. You know, as I mentioned to you before, I really thought it was made with love. And it's all about fishing. But tell us about the beginnings. When did you have the idea to launch this publication?
I actually first had the idea when I was about 18. It came from really an experience of having fished with my father, who was a journalist, but also a devout trout fisherman. As I moved into design, I sort of wanted to produce something that was representative of the kind of love that I attached to the pastime. But then I sort of parked that as I went through my career, and it was about 2014 where I had an opportunity to make it happen. I saw there was a bit of a gap in the market, maybe, you know, that's yet to be seen in sort of many senses, but I just kind of went and did it without any sort of planning. I just produced it and waited to see what the world thought of it. And here we are, sort of nearly, well, about 3.5 years later on.
Oh, and it's clearly, you know, doing well, as you say, issue 11, you know, after... And who is the market? Of course, people who fish, but do you think... Because, you know, I don't fish myself, but I'm quite interested. I was reading a lot of interesting articles, and I think this is something that I learned a few things as well.
it's interesting to ask who the market is, because actually we're continually finding it. I think that in many ways there's a sort of cultural, you know, zeitgeist for people to sort of move away from more consumerist titles and something that's produced with a little bit of care and attention, a little bit more care and attention. And so with that in mind, there are obviously many anglers in the country, but we can't aim for all of them, but we can aim for the people in that group that like something away from the mainstream. Traditionally, that have been sort of slightly older anglers, but actually we see that sort of cultural zeitgeist being sort of echoed in the younger population right now. So we're beginning to reach out to them. So we have readers from their 20s all the way up to 80s and occasionally beyond.
I read an article recently that in the world of fishing, you know, it's changing bit by bit, because as you say, before perhaps it was like older men, but now you have younger, you have more women as well doing it.
Yeah, there are many more women. It's a really interesting point of view, because, you know, it's quite difficult to actually get women to write for us in many ways, which is it's been a challenge. Yeah, we have had women write for us. We're continually searching for women who want to sort of take part in it. I think there's a sort of movement towards kind of almost celebrity angling in sort of many senses. And I think women are doing particularly well in that area, that we're seeing a lot of it on television. But I don't know how representative that necessarily is of the women on the ground, you know, or by the river, so to speak. But we do, we have them in mind, and we'd like to do more.
Before we talk about some of the stories, especially here in the issue 11 that I have it with me, what about the business model? I can see already that, you know, you guys offer a subscription, but do you sell newsstands? How do you work out with this? Perhaps some advertising as well?
From the very get-go, part of the inspiration behind producing something like this was being slightly fed up or kind of exhausted by the standard of the current angling magazines. And many of them are very advertising focused. And as a result of being very advertising focused, they have sponsored anglers within them who, you know, when they're talking about catching a fish, they're talking about also the advertiser who sponsors them. So actually every single article is a sales pitch. I made the decision at the very beginning to not have any advertising in it and to try and sustain the model through subscriptions, through newsstand sales. So initially it was all subs. The business model is actually, it is under pressure to become sustainable, but actually it's supported by me to a certain extent. And over the years, the business plan is for it to start to pay for itself. And we're kind of edging towards that. And newsstand sales are really interesting because we're beginning to get a greater purchase in the market. We've got a very exciting year ahead of us when a major distributor in the US want to bring us in there. And I think that might do great things for us. But also we're looking at other options here.
Oh, and the magazine looks beautiful. That's why I asked about the newsstand as well, because I think if I see something like this, I probably would be interesting to pick it up and buy a copy.
It's a really, really good point, because quite often when you, because we sell subscriptions through our website, and it doesn't necessarily convey the true beauty of the product. And like when you pick up a magazine, you can smell it, you can touch it. It's obviously got a matte finish. It's quite small in a sense. It's not A4. It's significantly smaller than that. It's quite thick. The paper has a good stock. So when you open it, you really feel that actually there's a moment to pause. You can read it on the train. You can read it wherever you are. But actually,
when you're fishing,
yeah. Actually, we get sent pictures from we've had people ice fishing in Canada who've sent us over some stuff, and a guy fishing in the Seychelles who's sitting there in a boat reading Fallon's Angler while fishing, I think, for marlin or something. But it's always quite exciting to see that. You're absolutely right. Nothing can convey the quality of it better than actually picking it up on a newsstand and seeing it for yourself.
Well, and because I'm becoming a bit interested in fishing, thanks to you, in a way. Where is a good spot, for example, here in the UK? Well, you can be anywhere in the world.
Yeah, you can be anywhere.
For a
beginner, I would go probably to the Wandle, which is sort of southwest London, and it flows for about 15 miles, I think, through southwest London into the Thames. And actually, Old Father Thames, you can't really beat that. There's plenty of fish in it further up. Good fish, actually, in central London, but, you know, they might be quite difficult to catch. But further up there, you know, as the river gets smaller, it gets a bit more fresh water in it, you can catch them there. But the Wandle certainly is a genuine chalk stream within probably 30 minutes of here, and you can fly fish for it. You know, you can catch trout there, quite big trout. You can get big gudgeon. You can get, I think there's more than 20 species been caught in that one little tiny river. So I would go there.
And it's interesting because I think fishing, again, I'm going to say, it's not only people that, you know, do it, but even on television you see like shows like, I know it might be a bit trashy, but like River Monsters. But I have to say, I've been fascinated by this since as a young child. So, and another thing that I like about Fallon's Angler, there's so many different stories. I mean, that you couldn't, like, how would you fill in a magazine about fishing? But well, for example, I love that story about building a fishing vessel.
Yes,
on issue 11. Such an interesting story.
That's very true, actually, because a big thing that happened for Fallon's Angler was after about issue 3, the photographer and writer Nick Fallowfield Cooper came on board in a sort of more permanent position, and he's now sort of essentially contributing picture editor for the magazine. And he's had a huge effect on the sort of look and feel of the photography. He deals with a lot of our contributors and helps them make sure that the kind of images are the right kind of quality for the mag. But he was the person who built the boat, and he's got an interesting sensibility towards angling. It's very soulful for him. So it was a hell of a journey for him to build that boat using his grandfather's, you know, woodworking tools, and sailing it on the River Lee, I think probably paddling it on the River Lee. Actually, there's another point. The River Lee is actually equally, that's a good river. That's on, you know, that's out east London. You can probably fish there too.
Another good spot.
Yeah, another good spot. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, when is the next issue coming out? How often does it come out?
We do our best to make it quarterly. It's not always possible, but because it's very organic. But we are doing 4 issues this year, and the next issue is in production right now, and we hope to get it to press by the end of January.
Fantastic. And Garrett, a question that I ask all editors, which other magazines do you read for inspiration? It doesn't need to be all about fishing, but, you know.
No, it doesn't. Actually, I think the first magazine that really caught my attention was a magazine in the 1980s called Geo. And I haven't seen it in a long time, but my father brought it home from work one day. We bought about 8 copies, and that had a huge effect on me. The ones that I read regularly, National Geographic, I think, is very important for me. Somebody who's interested in nature and a little bit more besides. But I'm very impressed with magazines like Another Escape. There's another magazine called Ernest, which I think they've done a really tremendous job on those.
That was Garrett Fallon, editor of Fallon's Angler, and issue 11 is out now. That's it for this week's programme. My thanks to our producers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rhys Sheridan, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments or queries are welcome as ever. Drop a note to Fernando. He's on fp@monocle.com. Don't forget to join us at the very same time next week. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for tuning in.